Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome.
Welcome to The Short Stacks, our shorter conversations with authors about their process and their books. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we're chatting with Maurice Carlos Ruffin, who is the author of the Stacks Book Club pick, We Cast a Shadow. We're going to do a spoiler-free look at this satirical speculative fiction novel and how it came into the world. Everything we talk about on today's episode can be found in the show notes. Use that link to shop for the books we've discussed and read the articles we mention. Plus, you'll find our social media accounts in the show notes, and it'll help keep you connected to the Stacks. If you love the show and you want more of it, check out our Patreon page. You can support the work we're doing, earn perks for yourself, and be connected to our amazing community of wonderful listeners. Go to patreon.com/thestacks. Audible is an online database of audiobooks, and listeners of this show can try it out for free. To get your free audiobook download and free 30-day trial, go to audibletrial.com/thestacks. If you like what you hear, please take a moment to rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts, especially if you're listening to us through Apple Podcasts. Okay, now it's time for my spoiler-free conversation with Maurice Carlos Ruffin. Okay, everybody, I am here today talking with Maurice Carlos Ruffin, the author of We Cast a Shadow. Maurice, welcome to the podcast.
Very happy to be here.
I'm so happy you're here. So we always start these episodes the exact same way. In about 30 seconds or so, can you tell us about your book?
Sure. So my book is about a family. The main character is an African-American lawyer who lives 50 years in the future in an unnamed southern city. And he's married to Penny, who is a white lady. And his child, Nigel, is mixed race. And the narrator is just really worried about the vicious effects of racism against his son. And so he decides the best way to protect his child from racism in America is to turn him white.
And where did you get this idea? How did this come to you?
It was a lot of different factors. I think like a lot of writers, just it was the sort of timing and things I had been thinking about. I had been thinking a lot about Trayvon Martin around that time when I started writing the book.
Okay.
And about people I knew who were not African-American like myself, who were white folks who just couldn't understand how I would see the tragedy in that young man's death. Mm. And I recognize you can have people who are otherwise well-intentioned but don't understand what a society can do to somebody who is othered. And so thinking about that, I said, well, you know, how would this exist in a narrative form? And who is this character? And he just sort of announced his presence one day, and there he was.
I love that. So first of all, this book is fantastic. We're talking about it on Wednesday on our podcast. Like, we're doing a whole deep dive, so we won't be spoiling anything here today. But I do kind of want to know, it's a satire. It's a little science fiction-y, maybe speculative fiction is a better way to say it. Why the satire part? Like, do you think you could have told the story in a non-satirical way, or not who you are, not what it is?
Well, I can give you a bunch of fancy answers as to why, but okay. I think the two simple answers that are true is that, one, when I write, I just want to have a good time. Whether I'm writing a short story or an essay or whatever, I just want to sort of enjoy the experience. And with such a dark topic, I think that if it had very little humor or satire, it would have been too heavy. But also, I'm from New Orleans, and New Orleans is a tourist city. And so I think most of our workers are working in the service industry, and there's a sort of blasé feeling towards tourists, not against them, but kind of like, oh, here come these tourists. They want another party. There's a party like every 10 minutes in this city, basically. Right. And so it becomes sort of, you know, humorous, just watching it happen over and over and over again. And I can tell you my experiences with racism is that, I mean, a simple example is that, walking into a store for the first time and being monitored by the sales clerk made me angry the first time it happened, and then confused the second time it happened. But by the fifth or 20th time it happens to you, it's kind of like, you know what, this is really hilarious. You know, there's my old friend racism watching me walk around the store.
Right.
So that's kind of how I thought about it.
Okay, I like that. That's a really good answer. So I am not huge on reading satire. I think it's really hard. I tell people I think it's like a muscle. I think you really have to flex your satire muscle as a reader, because if you're watching a film or a TV show that's satirical, the actors might give you some clues with their faces that they're joking. And so I think that the ability to write satire is got to be super challenging, because you have to be putting the nuance in your writing. You can't rely on
you know, Donald Glover to roll his eyes for you or whatever.
So true.
And you, this is your first novel, but you are a writer in addition to being a lawyer. Did you find that writing satire was more challenging than maybe writing something that's more straightforward?
You know, I think that satire is probably my natural mode.
Okay.
Again, being from this city and then growing up reading books, for example, like John Kennedy Toole's Confederacy of Dunces, for example,
mm-hmm.
which is set in New Orleans. It's written like 50 or 60 years ago now, and yet it's still like the tone of it like fits the city. People here have a great sense of humor.
Okay.
Also a gallows humor and a very quick humor that unveils itself slowly, you know, to outsiders. And so I think in writing the book, you know, I wanted the satire, but also, you know, I don't like satires that are too quippy or witty or glib or shallow.
Right.
And so I wanted to have like a beating heart, which is why the family is really the sort of center of everything that's going on here. To them, it's a very serious story.
Right. Of course. I do want to talk a little bit about the New Orleans part of the book or the city, as it is mm-hmm. called in the book. I shouldn't assume that it's New Orleans, but there's a lot of world building that you do throughout the book, kind of leaving us Easter eggs about things that we might recognize from our current world, but that are changed or similar in this future world. How much of the city is based on real life and how much of it is just you kind of going off and doing your thing?
Well, New Orleans is definitely a foundation. I don't say it's New Orleans and maybe it's not New Orleans. I think I may have thought of it as sort of a speculative future mm-hmm. in which maybe, you know, New Orleans is called something else. But, you know, the bottom line is that it's definitely a southern city and it definitely has a lot of the traits of this city, including streetcars and a sort of carnival parade that happens once a year and a lot of the sort of, you know, joie de vivre. And just geographically, some things I invented, like there is and there's this really gigantic mall that sits on the river called the Mall of the Seven Myrtles. Doesn't exist here in real life.
Right.
But I just sort of expanded it. And also these you know, the projects, the Ticolosi projects, you know. Here's me just sort of extrapolating using the past where we had these projects and these sort of malls that are gone now and making my own futuristic version of them.
Okay. What was the hardest part about writing this book and what about this book came easily to you?
You know, the hardest thing about it, I think that anybody who is taking on a serious topic, you know, whether it's sexual assault or suicide or racism, those are dark materials. And what happens is that to really engage with it and to try and create an experience for your reader, you have to really have this almost method actor's mindset of putting yourself into the main character's shoes and walking along with this person. And so I'll tell you, there were times where I was reading, you know, research material and getting prepared to write a chapter. And I would think, I just feel so sad right now. And I think that maybe in a strange way, the book took longer for me sort of like stopping occasionally for a week or so and just like not writing for a while so I could think about it and bring myself back to it. And I was lucky to have a lot of good friends and people in my life to keep me, you know, entertained and happy and full of life. But it was hard to you know, stay on that topic for 4 years.
Right. And what sort of research materials were you reading and going to?
Well, it varies. I mean, I think that I definitely read a good number of nonfiction books. I think maybe the first one I wrote for this read for this project was New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, which is just a wonderful book. And part of it is set in New Orleans, where she's researching like Tulane University and the policing of that university. I've watched a lot of movies, believe it or not. I'd never seen a film called Imitation of Life from the 1950s that really informed a lot of this idea of othering and passing for white and how you have to sort of bend yourself like a pretzel to fit into society. And a lot of online research, too, which is so convenient to have, you know, Wikipedia, Google, university resources, and that sort of thing as well.
Yeah. How did you come up with the title for the book?
You know, it took a while. And I think in my process, I'm the kind of writer where if I don't have a title that I'm 100% satisfied with, I know I'm not quite done with it. So I had many working titles. At one point, it was called Nigel after the son in the book.
Okay.
At one point, I think it was called The Sellout. And then Paul Beatty's book came out. And I was like, well, you can't do that.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, totally. And so I just... in my mind, on the very last day of me sitting in a coffee shop writing, like revising like the late version of this book, I kept sitting there thinking, all right, Maurice, just like put a bunch of titles on the screen and see what happens. And I put down We Cast a Shadow, which was based on an earlier title I had called All of the Lights, you know, Kanye West's song from Dark Fantasy. And I didn't want like Kanye West to see my All of the Lights title and kind of get mad and like attack me on Twitter. So I just reversed it from All of the Lights to We Cast a Shadow, okay. Which is sort of the photo negative version of that same title. And you know, there's a lot more shadows in the book than there's light, so it sort of fitted as well.
Yeah, well, that's so funny that you say that you said the sellout, just because now I'm thinking about that book, and your covers are kind of similar in the idea of like those fate, like the repeated image over and over and over.
Yes, absolutely.
And that had not dawned on me until I'm sitting here just now, and I'm like, you're an idiot.
You know, you're not, because you are the first person to point it out. And actually, I never made that connection myself.
Okay,
so
good.
Good on you.
I would not have made it if you hadn't literally said the sellout, but I'm glad that I took it there.
It's teamwork.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about Maurice, the writer person, aside from the book. So I know that you're a lawyer. And I know that our lead character, our narrator, is also a lawyer. So I guess the question is twofold. How much of you would you say is in the book? Which I know is kind of a weird, I sometimes don't like that question, but only because those two things match up. And I know that you're in New Orleans and it's a New Orleans-ish. But also, how much of the stuff about law firms is real?
Well... So the thing about it is that if I was not a lawyer, I'm not sure I could have written this book. The sort of source material of this book is my experiences as a lawyer over a 13 or 14 year period, give or take. And, you know, certainly law firms are very particular places. They're problematic across the board for misogyny, for, you know, anti-immigrant, comments because of race, because of the sort of classism. And I mean, I could just go down the list. I think for me as a black man in the South, being in a total of, I think, five different firms over that 13-year period, I saw a lot of things. And, you know, I can tell you it's funny. I tried to make the scenes that were set either in the law firm or at firm events seem as sort of surreal as possible. But I had at least one lawyer who worked for a local firm, you know, a middle-aged white guy, say, you could have went a lot harder and a lot darker, man. Like, people in these firms are saying things you would not believe. And my internal response was, well, you know, I don't get to like even hear a lot of that because a lot of those things are said behind closed doors where the power brokers are talking about women and minorities and that sort of thing. So I went out there, but apparently I could have went even farther.
Yeah, turns out. What kind of law do you practice?
Well, I'm semi-retired now. So I was a corporate defense lawyer, basically representing insurance companies, hospitals, restaurants.
Okay.
But now I pretty much teach creative writing full time at LSU in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Okay. So do you have to go to Baton Rouge a lot?
I do. I travel there a few times a week to teach my classes. And I actually enjoy the drive. I like listening to podcasts like yours or, playing music.
I've been to my people are from Baton Rouge.
No way.
Yeah. So I was actually, I drove from New Orleans when I was there for a wedding not too long ago to go try to see my dad's house, but it had been torn down, which was a bummer for me. But I did do the drive and it was beautiful.
Yeah. Well, you know, home, right?
Yeah. I'd never been. My dad never. And his people, they moved out to California in the 1930s. So he was a baby and they did the Great Migration thing and they went to San Francisco. And so he and my mom had been back to visit, but I had never been. I'd been to New Orleans, but I'd never been to Baton Rouge. So I drove by myself just like through the bayou. It was gorgeous, but it was a very surreal experience for me.
That's quite an adventure. I mean, that's amazing. And I guess I'm proud of your ancestors for making the decision to, I guess, get out for whatever their purposes were. You know, that's a good thing.
Have you read The Warmth of Other Suns?
You know, I've read most of it. I still have to, it's on my shelf. I have to finish reading it.
Okay. Well, part of it was that I'd finished that book in May of the year and I had a wedding in New Orleans. So I changed my whole thing. I flew in a day early. Like I was like, I have to go. I have to see. So anyways, totally off topic, but who cares? It's a podcast. That's why these things are great. Yeah. So you said it took you almost 4 years to write the book. Where did you do the writing? How did you find time to do the writing? How do you squeeze in just a casual novel into a teaching and law career?
Well, I think that for me, it's a few things. Well, number one, I like to write in coffee shops.
Okay.
And there's one here that I love. I just named it. It's called Orange Couch, which is in the Meridian neighborhood. just outside of the French Quarter. And I go there frequently in other shops as well, including Rook and a few other ones around town. But timing, you know, I think that a lot of writers have this feeling of, oh, you know, writing is so difficult. How will I find time to do it? Particularly when I was practicing full time as a lawyer and working 40 to 80 hours a week sometimes. I often felt like that little bit of time after work, maybe like on a Wednesday night at 8:30, going to a coffee shop and having that hour and a half to write just for myself, it was exhilarating. I felt like I was doing this really joyous thing. And now, you know, as a professor of creative writing, I gain energy from that also. I don't feel tired at the end of the day. I feel like, you know what? I've been talking about writing all day long. How great is that?
Yeah.
And it just gives me a good energy.
It's like your mental health break.
Yes. Yes. And now it's my life.
Yeah. Now it's your life. But that's so cool that you're able to turn it into your life. How do you write? So you go to your coffee shop. Do you have headphones in? Do you listen to music? Do you have a snack? Do you have a go-to beverage? Like, rituals, mm-hmm. What sort of stuff is in your writing space as you write?
On maybe a perfect morning, I might go to a shop on a Saturday morning, for example, and start bright and early, 7 o'clock, have a cup of coffee, maybe. I don't drink too much coffee, but I will sometimes. Have maybe some yogurt and granola, play around for a while. Like, I actually put playtime into my process.
Hmm.
I'm gonna go online for a while, like, just like surf the web, look at emails, write my personal journal on my computer for a few minutes. And then within an hour or so, I'll start writing. And for me, about 2 or 3 hours is like my max, maybe, I think. There have been times where I would go like an entire day, taking a lunch break, then going back and then writing one more time later at night or revising at night. And also, I'm kind of unusual in that I've had periods, like, for years, I would write to music in my headphones constantly. Like, I would just, like, for my short stories, each story had like its own like signature song that I would write to. And then also internet, people often say, you know, they can't write if they're plugged in the internet, they get distracted. For me, the distraction is part of my process. I love going down those sort of rabbit holes and finding things and kind of being like, yes, I need that in my story. And so for me, it's whatever works, whatever fits the narrative. And it's all part of my process.
Mm. Is there music that goes along with We Cast a Shadow?
I made a playlist for somebody a few months ago, but definitely... There were healthy doses of Kanye West from Dark Fantasy Era.
So
and that's
good.
His album. He's like, he's so complex in that album. Like, he's like, you know, I'm the baddest person on the planet, but I'm also so like confused and weak, and I'm going to die young. And I just love the way he just shapes that entire narrative in there. And I mean, I have a pretty wide swath of taste. I love Bjork. I love Joanna Newsom. I mean, Beyonce, of course, got to have some of her in there sometimes as well. I can go on and on and on, but I love a lot of stuff.
Okay, this is also off topic, but have you ever heard of the podcast Dissect?
No.
Okay, I'm about to change your life. You're welcome in advance. And the funny thing is, this actually came up when I was talking about your book with the guest that I talk about your book with. This podcast came up again, but it's called Dissect, and the host is this guy named Cole Kushner, and he does only hip hop albums. And he's kind of this like nerdy white guy. And he is a music guy. So he takes the album track by track and breaks it down. And he does all of My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. And he takes all the samples and he goes through the lyrics and he goes through everything. And I love that album since the day it came out. It's one of my favorites. I think it's one of the greatest albums. But he made me love that album in a whole new way. Like, songs that I usually skip now, 10 years later, he does a whole thing about the 9-minute Runaway. He takes it into two episodes to do all of Runaway. It's incredible what he does with the album. So it's called Dissect. It's the second season is the Kanye season. This current season he's doing now is he's doing Damn by Kendrick Lamar.
Yeah, yeah.
The guy is super nerdy, and I always warn people because it's almost jarring how nerdy he is. Like, you're kind of like, who are you? But he's a music theory person. So he talks about the key signature and the dissonance between the end of, you know, one song and the start of the next song, and how the first note in Runaway is actually the last note that finally resolves the song before. It's like stuff that blows your mind. So if you're into that album.
I am already there. I'm making a note to myself. Okay. I will be checking that out. I mean, all you have to say was hip hop and dissect. So I'm
into it. It's so good. It's so good. I just love the show. We're going on so many tangents today. I love it. I've lost my track of thought, but who cares?
But see, this is how my mind works, because I'm all like footnotes and tangents and parentheticals in my mind.
This is how my mind works too, but it can be a problem when you're hosting something and you have to be responsible for like the order and the time. It's great when you can just have a conversation, but oh, I know what I was going to ask you. Because your other job, aside from being a writer and being a creative, is being a lawyer, which is much more rigid, I would assume. Do those things work well together for you, or do you sometimes find it hard to take off your lawyery hat to sit down and get creative?
I think I was born to be a creative, and I think I sort of stumbled into law. Like many people these days go to law because it's sort of like the last result. You find a lot of English majors in the law, for example, and a lot of lawyers who have these other talents, whether it be acting or dancing or whatever. And I think that for me, the law has been very, very helpful in that it gave me a sense of discipline. I'm very good at just sitting down and writing for an hour or, you know, an hour and a half and just getting it done without fretting too much, you know, sort of bulldozing through writer's block. And then also the feeling of, I think in my younger days, I was very flowery in my writing, and law made me much, much more succinct and efficient and direct in my writing. And so, and then lastly, I have a lot of gumption. You know, if I get a no, I don't take that as the final answer. You know, with the submissions process and my short stories, for example, I would just figure out new techniques to fight forward. And I've been very successful in getting stories published, getting my novel published, and getting other things published. And that gumption is an important part of being a successful writer, I think.
And did you always want to be a writer? Was that always part of who you were? Or is that something that came to you later in life?
I definitely always enjoyed literature and storytelling in all its forms, whether it's talk, you know, whether it's like a Toni Morrison book I would have read as like an 11-year-old, or a Maya Angelou, or, you know, comics and film and, you know, those things were all part of my world. But like a lot of writers, if you don't know a writer personally, you don't know how you get to that place, you know, how you become a quote unquote writer. And so it was like my personal hero's journey, I say, to like take 15 years to figure out how to go from being this guy who really wants to like try to write a novel to, wow, I wrote a novel. How about that?
And this is kind of a everyman question. What's the word that you can never spell right on the first try?
Oh, there's a couple of them. Oh, I was talking to my students last night, and I was trying to write something on the board, and I could not get it right. See, I'm good at hieroglyphics and arpeggios, but I'm bad. So there's a name. I can't get Virginia Woolf's last name right ever on the first try.
Okay.
Sometimes I can't recognize which, like, you know, whether or which.
Okay.
I can't, like, I just keep thinking, well, how do you spell it? Or maybe some, it's really weird like that. Words like assiduous and conscientious, like lots of C's and S's. I just can't figure out how many S's to put into it or how many, you know. So, yeah, those kind of words as well.
I love it. I just love hearing, because writers write and you think they're just do-do-do-do-do-do. Like, you don't think they ever have to backspace.
Oh, no. Spell check is a lifesaver. Thank
goodness. I don't know how people did it before spell check.
I don't know. I don't understand.
I can't even send an email, a casual email, without having to go back and fix it. For people who love We Cast a Shadow, what are some other books that you might recommend to them?
Oh, my goodness. There's so many of them. I'll start from present and I'll work backwards a little bit. So I highly recommend Sarah Broom's The Yellow House. And that book is nonfiction. She's up for a National Book Award right now. We're from the same little neighborhood called New Orleans East, which is like 98% African-American. And the way she details the sort of geography and the family life of that area, I see some of my own like thoughts and writing on her pages. Mm-hmm. And so we're like related as writers in this community. Matt Johnson has a book called Pym. Pym is his take on Edgar Allan Poe's only novel. It's this weird sort of racial allegory. It's very bizarre and very amazing. Anything by, for example, of course, we know Jasmine Ward. We have KSA Lehman. I love what they do. Those two writers in particular are so good at showing the sort of abundance of the Black experience.
Yeah.
You know, KSA is a person who made me like love Mississippi, which I always kind of avoided. You know, as a Southerner, I'm like, you know what? We're bad in Louisiana, but Mississippi, my goodness, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I see how he presents the strength of Black families in culture, and I love that so much. And I guess lastly, I think about books like you know, this book was in part inspired by Ralph Ellison in Invisible Man. And when I read that book as like an 18-year-old in college, I kept thinking, you know, this is what it feels like to be myself in the world. And I've not seen this anywhere else in anything else. Mm. And a big part of my journey of writing this book was to kind of say, you know what, I want to pay homage to that as much as I possibly can. And so he sort of made me as a writer in a lot of ways. And that book was really helpful to me.
So my listeners will be hearing this before they hear the episode where we talk about your book. But Chris L. Terry, who's my guest when we talk about your book, he actually says...
Race card.
Yeah.
Black card.
Yeah. He says something along the lines of, there's no way that this book isn't inspired by Invisible Man. And he says something very similar about his experience with Invisible Man, that it was something that changed the way that he kind of understood how and who could be a writer.
Ellison has many children. And yeah. I mean, even I think the man who wrote The Sympathizer.
Viet Nguyen.
Yeah, Viet Nguyen. Viet Nguyen, exactly. I mean, he said he was inspired by that.
Yeah.
And I think Ellison was maybe one of the very first people to give us a real sort of psychological insight to what it means to be othered in the West. And he did it just so well. I mean, it resonates even today.
I actually have not read that book. It's on my list. It's been on my list forever. It's one of the
Check
ones
it out.
I'm sort of embarrassed that I haven't read. But, you know, there's just so many.
There are so many books.
But I have read Black No More, which reminds me of your book, obviously.
George Shuler.
Yeah. Because they're in the same kind of world. They go different directions, but they kind of start in similar places.
You know what's funny about that? That book has been mentioned more times than any other book in my interviews. I've never read it. I know what it's about. And I think like my explanation for how that works is that I think that so many of us writers, people of color, are sort of joined across time. Like we're holding hands almost.
Mm-hmm.
So my premise is almost the exact same premise, just, you know, 80 or 90 years later. But certainly it shows you that we're facing the same issues that were being faced back then. And we're trying to figure out how to approach these things and talk about them in a way that makes sense to ourselves and to non-people of color.
Yeah, it's true. Your books are definitely, like I said, they kind of start in the same place and they do go different directions, but they're obviously dealing with the same sorts of questions. And
yes.
It's just a matter of who kind of your protagonists are.
Yes.
That takes them in different places, which is to say that having good, strong characters makes a huge difference.
Absolutely.
So because you're talking about race and you're not talking only to Black people in your book, have you received pushback on this book? And if so, was any of it stuff that you agreed with?
That's a good question. And first of all, I mean, the book has some scenes that are very, very intense.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it involves physical abuse sometimes, and that can be hard to think about at all. If you combine that with race and gender and everything else that's going on in this book, those moments are difficult. And I have had at least like one or two readers. Well, maybe the funniest reader was somebody, it was the first comment on Amazon. She says, you know, Maurice Ruffin is a troublemaker for talking about this at all, period, in this way. And I think I smiled when she said that because I kept thinking, you know what? If I wasn't making trouble, it wasn't worth writing this story.
Mm.
And as I look back on it now, I think, well, you know who said it best? I saw it this morning. Jeremy Harris, who has that play, Slave Play, up in New York right now. He was on a TV show this morning. And he said, you know, if I offended anybody or hurt anybody with my writing, you know, I understand that, I accept that, and I can't reject it. But in a sense, I'm only talking to myself.
Mm.
And so if I'm hurting anybody, I'm hurting myself. But you know, if you overheard my conversation, then that's on you.
Mm.
And, you know, maybe it's a content warning, or maybe it's just like, you know, that's part of what art does. Art is going to make you feel uncomfortable and make you feel a little strange inside. And if it doesn't, then maybe it's not really art.
Right. And if you're writing satire and you're not making trouble, you're probably not doing very good.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, I feel like that's the whole point of writing a satire. Otherwise, why wouldn't you just write a memoir or a novel that is, this is the way the world is, right? Like,
everything is so nice.
Yeah.
No problems.
You could do that, but it wouldn't be satire.
We've overcome everything. All the problems have been vanquished.
Yes. In this near future in the city, there's no race. Nobody sees color. Who's the coolest person who's expressed interest in this book or who you've heard from that read it that made your heart sing?
Oh, my goodness. So many people. I mean, I'll go with the most recent person, Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, who his most recent book is How to Be an Anti-Racist. And he wrote Stamped from the Beginning, which won the National Book Award.
If anybody's listening to this podcast and doesn't know who that is, they must be a brand new listener because he's one of my faves.
Yeah, so he was on a podcast back in September, which I wasn't even aware of it. And then somebody retweeted it on Twitter like 2 or 3 days ago, and he was talking about my book in like 2 different segments in that show. And he was like so into like the main character and the problems presented. He's like, this book is so complex. And I was like, oh, well, that's all I need. I mean, that's it. You know, I've reached the pinnacle.
Do you know what podcast it was?
Long Reads.
Okay. I'm going to link to it in the show notes for people if they want to hear
that. Yeah, the September 3rd episode. Yes.
Okay. Oh my God. That's such a cool person. Okay. If you could have one person, dead or alive, read your book, who would it be?
Oh my goodness. Oh man, that's a tough one. Whew. I would love to know what Toni Morrison would have thought about it because she's such a hero to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't have any connection to her personally, but her books have touched me so much. Mm. And I know that I'm not even, you know, half the writer that she is. But I think that the sort of courage she had and the ability to just put things out there and not fear what people would say about it, that's such a big part of what I try and do in my writing. And her brain was just so huge. So I can only imagine where she would go in talking about what I wrote.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good person. Maurice, that's all I have for you today. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, this was wonderful. I'm so happy to have been a part of this.
Me too. And everyone else listening at home, make sure you go get your copy of We Cast a Shadow. It's been out in the world for a while now, so you can get it wherever you get your books. And tune in on Wednesday. We're going to be discussing this book in more detail with spoilers. So make sure you read it before you listen. But Maurice, thank you so much for being here. And everybody else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you for listening to The Short Stacks, and thank you to Maurice Carlos Ruffin for chatting with me today. Everything we talk about on today's show can be found in the show notes. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media, at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. To join The Stacks Pack and get inside access to this show and more, go to patreon.com/thestacks and join the fun. Thank you to Audible. Listeners of this podcast get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to this show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirages. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas, and I will see you in the stacks.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because... the charcoal mask! Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink? This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera. Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.